If there was a Mount Rushmore of umbilical cord researchers, Dr. Junichi Hasegawa would be on it. I was fortunate to catch up with him at the 2017 Stillbirth Summit in Bloomington, Minnesota. Hi, everyone. You're listening to episode 4 of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Today's guest, Dr. Junichi Hasegawa, is an associate professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at St. Mariana University School of Medicine in Tokyo, Japan. Dr. Hasegawa has been awarded the scientific award of both the Japan Society for Obstetrics and Gynecology and Japan Society for Reproductive Medicine. His extensive research focuses on ultrasound evaluation of the umbilical cord and placenta, early detection of placental abruption, and ultrasound evaluation in early gestations. Well, Dr. Hasegawa, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
My first question is, umbilical cord accidents are a controversial and confusing issue in the United States. We know that umbilical cord issues cause many stillbirths and birth injuries, but yet there are not solid plans to look for and manage umbilical cord issues. How do you manage this in your practice?
Fetal death and non-reassuring fetal status often involves umbilical cord and placental abnormalities. However, guidelines for management of these problems have not yet been established in Japan. Placental and umbilical cord abnormalities are considered to account for around 30% of the causes of intrauterine fetal death. Among cases involving cord abnormalities, hypercoiled cord, velamenous cord insertion, umbilical ring constriction, and umbilical cord prolapse are considered to be causes of stillbirth. Cord accidents, hypoxia due to umbilical cord occlusion, may be associated with long-term disabilities such as cerebral palsy, even for babies who are saved. According to the analysis of a nationwide registration system of cerebral palsy in Japan, an estimated 30% had placental abnormalities and 15% had umbilical cord abnormalities. In umbilical cord abnormalities, umbilical cord prolapse, abnormal cord insertion, hypercoiled cord, umbilical cord constriction, and multiple cord entanglements were also associated with cerebral palsy. When I was a resident doctor, I encountered a neonate with severe distress born from a low-risk mother. After delivery, velamenous cord insertion was revealed and considered as neonatal distress. Although this baby became better due to neonatal care, I thought that prenatal ultrasound could be used to find such pathological conditions in pregnant women. Therefore, today I'm studying and doing research of placenta and umbilical cord abnormalities. According to my research, I believe not only prenatal ultrasound diagnosis of placenta and umbilical cord abnormalities, but also fetal heart rate tracing during labor can improve the perinatal mortality and morbidity rate. I think at least stillbirth or severe fetal compromise during labor are preventable. As a limitation, sudden stillbirth before onset of labor is difficult to predict, especially in normal growth fetuses.
Does telling your patients about potential umbilical cord issues scare your patients or alter their pregnancy experience?
When I find an umbilical cord, an abnormal umbilical cord, I always explain to the pregnant women the exact situation, because some previous studies showed that almost all cases with umbilical cord abnormality, such as vasa previa, that were prenatally known survived, while only half of the cases without prenatal diagnosis survived. When ultrasound diagnosis of severe umbilical cord abnormalities were made, patients would feel regret for their diagnosis. However, in most babies in this situation, I believe stillbirth is preventable with appropriate management, and that is frequent ultrasound examination and fetal heart rate tracing enable us to show fetal conditions.
There are many issues with umbilical cords that can be concerning. Which issues do you tend to look for the most? Are there any that can't be identified on ultrasound? How do you manage them?
I think vasoprevia.
Vasoprevia. Vasoprevia is a form of velamentous cord insertion in which the aberrant vessels traverse the fetal membranes on or near the internal cervix. Vasoprevia has unsupported fetal vessels below the fetal presenting part. So those fetal vessels are easily compressed or ruptured when the uterus contracts or membrane rupture occurs, resulting in fetal exsanguination. Intrapartum clinical diagnosis is difficult and thus rarely made. Therefore, prenatal ultrasound diagnosis and elective cesarean section around 36 weeks gestation before rupture of membrane or onset of labor is necessary.
You've done a lot of research around placental health and placental abruptions. What have you learned about causes of placental abruption and early signs of an abruption?
I think diagnosis of placental abruption is difficult, especially when symptoms such as bleeding and abdominal pain are small. It is also important to know that detection rate of placental abruption by ultrasound is low. Fetal heart rate monitoring patterns tend to vary in the early stage of abruption. We should determine by looking at the symptoms comprehensively.
It is my understanding that pregnant women in Japan receive ultrasound examinations at most prenatal visits. What are the primary things that these tests look for? Is there any concern about the number of ultrasounds in a pregnancy? Do you think it improves care or pregnancy outcomes?
Certainly, in Japan, many ultrasound examinations are done in pregnancy checkups. Most doctors perform these at every checkup. The reason is ultrasound equipment exists in the examination room, and every pregnant Japanese woman wants an estimate of fetal weight. Usually, doctors measure fetal weight and amniotic volume as a routine examination. I think at least growth-restricted fetuses are antenatally diagnosed in Japan. It might be associated with the low perinatal mortality rate in Japan, but this is conjecture.
So let me ask a question that many of our listeners in the United States are probably wondering. Japan has a lower stillbirth rate than in the U.S., and we'd like to know why that's the case. There's often speculation that it may result from different diets, fewer cases of maternal obesity, increased activity levels, increased use of alternative medicine. We could go on and on. Do you agree with any of these suggestions, or do you have some of your own? Basically, we just want to know, why does Japan have a lower stillbirth rate than the U.S.?
I think such different maternal characteristics
might be associated with the different mortality rate. Frequent ultrasound examination and maternal checkups can detect pathologic conditions until complications become severe. In fact, we can find maternal and fetal compromise, including preeclampsia, fetal growth restriction, and oligohydramnios near the term, and then induction of labor is recommended.
We are learning more and more about the placenta and how it functions. What do you consider the best opportunities for identifying alterations in placental function?
Difficult question. So far, there are no methods to predict placental.
So far, there are no methods to predict placental dysfunction. I do try to measure this function. I think placental weight or volume indicate placental function. Doppler assessment of placenta and uterine artery are also used. However, they have limitations.
Well, Dr. Hasegawa, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to participate in our podcast, and thank you for traveling all the way to the United States to participate in the Stillbirth Summit. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
That concludes episode 4 of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. This episode was recorded at the 2017 Stillbirth Summit in Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.